My nomination for headline of the day so far: planet-like object nicknamed for Vice President Joe Biden. Do we know how the Veet feels about becoming the namesake for a planet-like object? How might you feel? Flattered, perhaps, or maybe a bit put off to be that closely associated with deep space. Candidly, the Vice President, as a person, was not the inspiration for the name. We want to make that clear. Scientists labeled this dwarf planet just beyond Pluto VP-113. The rest was written in the stars. Welcome back to Current State. Later this hour, we get to know a special visitor to West Michigan from Cambridge, England. Conductor Andrew Nethsinga is involved with performances of the Grand Rapids Choir of Men and Boys. Also meet Douglas Meeks and Greg McNeely, a newly married same-sex couple from Lansing, coming up in just a little bit. At the top of our program all this week, veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been in Washington, D.C. to lobby for legislation aimed at reducing the numbers of veteran suicides. They also have a focus on the trouble some veterans have in finding employment after their service days are over. Joining us from Washington today are two Michigan veterans who have spent the week talking with representatives and senators as part of the effort called Storm the Hill. They are Ingrid Tye, an employment analyst with the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency, and Nick Cook, the MVAA's Director of Targeted Outreach and Performance Management. Ingrid, Nick, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having us, Mark.
Ingrid, tell us a little bit more about the organization Storm the Hill.
Yes, Storm the Hill is an initiative through the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, otherwise known as IAVA. It is an organization. It is a nonpartisan group of veterans representing the newest generation of veterans coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan. Although they represent primarily those people from that generation, they do welcome other veterans from other eras. It's a group of 270,000 members nationwide, and they take on issues that are important to veterans. This year, the issue with Storm the Hill, which is an annual campaign that they do, they bring in veterans from all over, and they address the pertinent issues of the day, and they make policy changes and advocate on behalf of veterans. And this year, the Storm the Hill campaign is advocating on behalf of those veterans who have suffered and maybe some who have succumbed to suicide. And the goal is to reduce and eliminate suicide amongst veterans this year.
And this is an issue that hits fairly close to home, especially for you, Nick. Tell us about your relationship to this issue.
Well, Mark, you know, suicide has touched every single veteran out there. 47% of those in IAVA said it was their top issue this year, mental health and suicide prevention. And 42% of those surveyed said they knew somebody who had died by suicide, of that 250,000 in IAVA. But for me, about a year ago, I had a classmate from West Point who took his own life. And I struggled with my own issues. After my second deployment, I came back home, felt disconnected, anger. And I had suicidal ideations. Because of my family and my support structure, I was able to get help. Nothing ever came of anything besides the suicide ideations, but there's thousands of veterans out there that don't have a great support system, that need everybody's help. And this comprehensive bill that is going to be introduced today by Senator Walsh, the first senator out of from the Iraq and Afghanistan conflict, is going to address some of those issues that veterans face.
I understand the suicide rate among veterans of these two wars is roughly twice the larger population.
Well,
right.
Yeah.
We know that the statistic that is generally accepted and through the VA is right now 22 suicides a day amongst veterans. Mm. Speculation, though, is that that's on the low side.
My word. And Ingrid, I understand another priority here for you are barriers to jobs, barriers to veterans' employment. Tell us about that.
Correct. We have many veterans who are getting out of the military, and they have great skills. They have received top-notch training through the military, and then they have received great experience subsequently through carrying out those jobs in the military. It's really a shame when veterans come home and then have trouble finding employment. One of the biggest barriers, though, that we see is the cultural gap between civilian employers and veterans. What happens often is a veteran might have difficulty communicating his or her skill set to a civilian employer. We in the military are very used to acronyms and military jargon, and sometimes it's difficult to learn in the beginning how to communicate that into civilian terms. So that's one of the biggest obstacles that we work with right now. And then on the other side, we work with employers on educating them about what it is people do in the military. We talk to them about the training that veterans have received, and we help them kind of better understand what kind of leadership, dedication, discipline, and motivation and skills that those veterans bring to the table, and how these veterans can make great people for an employer's workforce.
We're talking with Ingrid Tai and Nick Cook, who are part of the Storm the Hill effort, advocating on behalf of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, in particular with a particular focus on suicide prevention and joblessness. Nick, did you say you served in Iraq or Afghanistan?
I had two combat tours to Iraq. My first one was in 2004-2005, and it was in Samarra, Iraq, and my second deployment was during the surge in 2007 to 2008 in Baghdad.
Tell us about your experience lining up work or attempting to get a job when you got back home.
Well, you know, I continued to serve in the Army until 2013, and when I decided to make that transition, it was difficult, and finding employers that understood what I've been through, what my job skills were. You know, I was a troop commander in combat, a lot of leadership. I actually had a company in Michigan reject my application because I did not have a bachelor's of science in leadership, even though I went to West Point and had leadership positions in combat. They said that did not qualify as leadership.
Tell us about the people you've met with on the Hill. You alluded to Senator Walsh of Montana, who appears to be squarely behind your effort here. Which other members of Congress have you met with?
From the Michigan delegation, we met with Representative Wahlberg, Representative Upton, Representative Benishek, and they were all behind us. Especially Representative Benishek and Representative Wahlberg, they've seen this firsthand. You know, we also met with Senator Levin's office. They have they've kind of stayed a little bit quieter on the subject, but they understood the need for this legislation. And I know Ingrid met with Senator Stabenow also.
Ingrid? Yes, I met with Senator Stabenow and also Representative Mike Rogers' office.
Have you noticed any difference regarding how Republicans versus Democrats in Congress respond to your message?
Overall, I think it has been a bipartisan effort. I feel that most people have been very supportive and very enthusiastic about supporting veterans. I personally, in my interactions, did not see too much of a difference between either side of the aisle.
Mark, the one thing I did notice is veteran suicide has touched almost every member of Congress. They either have a soldier that they knew that died by suicide, or they had heard stories from constituents about their veteran that had suffered and decided to die by suicide. You know, that's, you know, 22 a day over the last, since 2001 when the conflict began. That's 100,000 suicides of veterans compared to the 8,000 that have died in combat.
Yeah. Tremendous. Now, the two of you were chosen from thousands of applicants for Storm the Hill. How did you two get chosen for this, Ingrid?
Well, I wasn't in the selection process, but I think a lot of it had to do with my background as a combat veteran, understanding the issues with healthcare. They also it touched on some other issues that had to do with military sexual trauma. I dealt with some soldiers in my unit who experienced that firsthand. And then also just a passion for fighting for veterans, both in Michigan with the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. I'm just very enthusiastic about giving back to everybody who served. And so I think that probably had a lot to do with it.
Where did you serve, Ingrid?
I served for a year over in Baghdad, Iraq. I was with the 1st Cavalry Division from 2004 to 2005.
And Nick, what's next? How do you follow? How do you track the progress of your proposals?
Well, this is a year-long campaign. We're going to continue to press Congress to push through this bill. We also have done a ask of the executive branch, asking the president to appoint a national director of suicide prevention to start that national dialogue. We are representing veterans. But this is a national issue. This isn't just about veterans. This is about the whole United States. And then we're also going to start focusing our efforts in state and in our local communities to start this national dialogue.
Well, Nick Cook and Ingrid Tai of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency, we want to thank you for your service, and thanks for joining us today on Current State. Good luck.
Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. The lives of one Lansing couple took a profound and very public turn last weekend. After more than 12 years in a serious relationship, attorney Douglas Meeks and investment executive Greg McNeely became one of Michigan's first same-sex couples to be legally married. The union became possible after last Friday's reversal of the state's ban on same-sex marriage. Many people have viewed an online video of the couple's vows, which took place at the Ingham County Courthouse, to talk about their experience, the legal limbo in which they now find themselves, as well as about the future. Current State welcomes Douglas Meeks to Studio S. Hi, Doug.
Thank you.
And Doug's new spouse, Greg McNeely, joins us by phone. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Mark.
Doug, on Tuesday, the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals suspended Judge Friedman's ruling to consider arguments against lifting the ban. What is it like for you to be in legal limbo like this?
Well, it's disappointing to have the Sixth Circuit come down that way. They had looked at the argument, and basically there's a Utah case that is similar to ours, and basically the Supreme, or they looked at it and said that the Supreme Court had already put a stay in place regarding the Utah case, and that's why they were doing it. I wish the Sixth Circuit would have looked at the case in front of them and done an analysis, because I don't believe that the stay would be appropriate at that point. But it's been a disappointing. It was very disappointing.
Greg, yesterday Governor Snyder said couples in your situation who were married over the weekend are indeed legally married, but that the impending ruling still matters. What do you take away from that?
Well, I think it was a very important directive that the governor gave. I mean, to those 300 couples, that's obviously very personally impactful. It means a lot. He didn't have to say that. He could have said it was pending litigation. But his hands are tied because, as Doug mentioned, the court has issued this stay, and the constitutional amendment goes back into effect. And so the state is very limited at this point during the appeals process. But as this process works out, to have the governor of the state tell those 300 couples that their marriages are legal is a historic step in the right direction.
Doug, you shared with me that you know other same-sex couples who want to get married but need to wait for this issue to be resolved. What's it like for you to consider that you have something that many other same-sex couples desperately want?
Well, it's sad. And again, you know, we're stated as to saying that we're married, but we don't receive the same benefits that other married couples in the state of Michigan currently have. And so in some aspects, we're back in the same spot we were previously. We're in a long-term relationship, and our benefits aren't capable of giving or being given to one another. For my friends, it's a sad situation. We have friends that have families that we have a friend that has a two-year-old, and they're in limbo, and they're going to continue to be in limbo. And the sad thing is that it looks at or appears that this will go to the Supreme Court, but we're looking at 2 years off. And when you look at 2 years off regarding this, that's 2 years of instability for families like our friends who have a two-year-old that only one has been able to adopt. It affects the adoption rights of them. And so it's sad to watch that. We've also had friends that were in the wrong place in line and unfortunately couldn't get married when the stay came down. So it's frustrating.
Greg, do you two have plans that involve kids?
It's been an ongoing conversation. And the instability that the current legal process is in is one of concern, and it also limits opportunities.
5 days after your marriage here, Douglas, with the excitement of the moment presumably fading at least a little bit, how do you feel 5 days after the ceremony?
Well, it's been a whirlwind, and I think that it's been a great whirlwind. We've experienced in our relationship an even stronger bond, and I didn't really know if that was even possible going into it. But there's the connotation of marriage and like how, for example, my parents have been together for 45 years. And so entering into the marriage relationship has strengthened our relationship even further, and it's been fun to We've been cute about it, being like, oh, well, this is the first time we've been to Costco together since we've been married. So, you know, it's been a great week.
Greg, how did you two meet?
We met through a mutual friend. It was a casual meeting, and we began conversing, and the relationship developed through conversation. I mean, it was one of those chance encounters that you look back on and are just blissful that it occurred.
How long after you met did you realize you wanted to spend the rest of your life with Doug?
Boy, that's a tough question. I definitely had a high interest level very early, but I'm not sure 12 and a half years ago that I was thinking in terms of forever and ever. But that quickly developed as I realized the power of having that connection and having a soulmate, somebody that really understands who you are, and conversely, that is just a powerful gift that I hope everyone in life gets to experience.
Doug, what about you? How did you know you wanted to spend the rest of your life with Greg?
Well, it took me a little while longer, I think, than Greg, but one day I looked across, he was talking to someone, and I just knew. I absolutely knew, and I was like, I didn't know this was going to happen.
You know, married couples have to agree on the chronology to some extent, so I might just advise you, as a guy who's been married over 30 years, some of these details you kind of have to be in sync on, just a little bit of advice there.
I'd appreciate if you didn't get us into our first marital spat on the air, but...
Greg, a lot's been made of your politics. You're the chief operating officer of the WinQuest Group, the investment management firm headed by former Republican gubernatorial candidate Dick DeVos. Do you think curiosity people have with that is justified?
It's a little justified, not as justified as the intensity has borne. You know, I think in the end, matters of the heart should not be political. That is one of the problems with government involvement in marriages. It's just too clumsy of a entity to regulate the heart. But it's not surprising. But in this day and age, I think you know, people should look at people as individuals and allow the private lives of folks to remain private.
We're talking with Douglas Meeks and Greg McNeely, who were among Michigan's first same-sex couples to be legally married last weekend at the Ingham County Courthouse. Douglas, how do you defend your views to people who make clear that they think marriage is between a man and a woman?
Well, I think that I look at it this way. They're entitled to believe what they want to believe regarding it, but the state shouldn't be picking winners and losers. It should be picking equality and under equal protection. And Judge Friedman, I think, nailed it dead on in his opinion, that under equal protection, the state should recognize similarly situated people, and our relationship is just as similarly situated as a married couple. And so if religions don't want to recognize it, that's completely their prerogative regarding it, but the government shouldn't be picking winners and losers.
Doug, Governor Snyder has sidestepped social issues during his tenure. Do you wish he took positions more often on social issues like same-sex marriage?
Well, it's unfortunate. I think that Governor Snyder is in a position to take a leadership role. And yesterday was a little bit sad for me, because I don't think that he led to the degree that he could. And I mean, it's just frustrating in that aspect. And I think that standing on the sidelines regarding history taking place, it just is a lack of leadership on his part.
Greg, what do you think?
Well, and this is a great example of where, jokingly, Doug and I always say that we cancel each other out when we go into the voting booth. I have a little bit of a different perspective. I think the governor showed tremendous leadership, and in terms of actually making decisions and taking action, has done and led as much as he is capable under the law in this arena. I believe he was elected to fix Michigan's economy. And while it's not done being fixed, it's turned around and come a long way. And so I think his focus there has been appropriate. You know, trying to not get mired in social issues is understandable. But I believe he showed leadership and compassion yesterday.
How often do you two talk politics?
Let's just put it this way. Every 4 years is a difficult time in our household.
Don't tell me. One of you is a Spartan fan and one of you is a Wolverine fan, too. Right?
Absolutely not.
Oh, no. We're both Spartan.
No, we're Spartan fans.
Okay. We got some peace going on there. Tell us about Saturday and standing there in the courthouse, Douglas.
Well, it was an amazing morning. It was a whirlwind, and it's been a whirlwind ever since. But we woke up, and I had found out through Sam Singh's tweet that Byram was opening up, and I had some other friends that were getting married, and I had called them to let them know that Barb was opening up, and they had said, well, we're getting married, and I looked over at Greg, or I woke him up, actually, and said, hey, our friends are getting married. Let's go watch them. We had been, I had been in their wedding previously and in the state. And so while we were getting ready, I popped the question and he said yes. And the next thing I know, I'm texting my family trying to get them all there as quickly as possible.
We've heard stories of couples who've left the state to move where gay marriage is legal. Greg, did you ever consider that?
Yeah, that, you know, We had been discussing the marriage issue for several years, and part of our shared value set is that we're committed to Michigan, and we believe in our home state, and we wanted to wait and take advantage of the opportunity to join marriage when it was available in our home state, and in the state that we're invested in, and we're committed to this community, and so when that window opened on Saturday, it was an easy decision to jump through.
That suggests some confidence that that was going to happen. Am I right? Were you confident that Michigan would reach that point?
Whether it's Michigan or any other state, I think we're in the middle of an obvious transition where we know where this story goes. We know where it ends up. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And so, yeah, absolutely confident that it would happen in Michigan, either through judicial action or another ballot initiative. You know, Michigan has a great progressive history. First state to repeal prohibition, first state to eliminate the death penalty. You know, we're a little bit lagging on this issue, but it was I think obvious to both of us that it would happen at some point in Michigan.
Are you Douglas? Are you as confident about the future as Greg sounds?
Absolutely. I think the writing is on the wall, and I think Judge Friedman did a phenomenal job in his ruling regarding the equal protection analysis. I think that seven other U.S. district courts throughout the nation have found similarly equal protection applies, and I think it's even interesting that two of the most conservative judges on the Supreme Court have, in their dissent, basically stated that after certain rulings that this would open the way to gay marriage.
We want to thank both of you for joining us here this morning. It's been great hearing your perspectives on all of these issues, and we wish you well as well. Doug Meeks is a Lansing-based attorney. His new spouse, Greg McNeely, joined us on the phone. He's an investment executive. Many thanks for joining us on Current State. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. 90.5 classical producer and afternoon music host Jody Knoll joins me now with a story about an unusual choir of men and boys based in Grand Rapids who will present a Lenten season program this Friday and Saturday at St. Andrew's Cathedral in downtown Grand Rapids. Jody, welcome to Current State.
Hi, Mark. Thanks.
You have a connection to this choir. Tell us about it.
I do. Well, my friendship with the Grand Rapids Choir of Men and Boys director Scott Bosher goes back nearly 40 years when we sang together in choirs and musicals at Grand Rapids Christian High. That friendship grew at Calvin College, where we traveled with the Calvin Capella Choir to England during a January interim to study the English choral tradition. Scott now conducts the Grand Rapids Choir of Men and Boys, who've brought in the director of the St. John's College Choir, Andrew Nethsinger, to be in residence this week, culminating in two concerts this weekend. St. John's College Choir is at Cambridge University in England and is considered one of the finest choirs in the world. I spoke with both Scott and Andrew earlier this week. Andrew's father, Lucian Nethsinger, grew up in Sri Lanka, where he was a boy treble in an Anglican choir there. He went on to study in Cambridge, England, and later became organist and choir master of Exeter Cathedral, where in turn his son Andrew was a choir boy. Andrew studied organ and choral conducting and served as organist under the legendary George Guest at St. John's College Choir. In 2007, he returned to lead the choir. I began by asking Andrew about the history of St. John's College.
It dates back, in a sense, 800 years to an infirmary that was there on the site. But the college itself was founded by Lady Margaret Beaufort in 1511. So we're relatively new, only 503 years. Yeah.
How about the choir itself?
And the choir's even newer, yeah. Didn't start until the 17th century.
Well, George Guest led the St. John's Choir for 40 years, from 1951 to 1991. Guest had a similar pathway to yours in that his father, too, was a cathedral organist, though his roots were in Wales. The boy sopranos, or trebles, as they're known in your line of work, under George Guest took on what's been called a continental sound. How would you describe that sound and how it differs from other English choirs?
I think probably his two greatest influences were Boris Ord, who ran the choir at King's College, and George Malcolm, who ran the choir at Westminster Cathedral. And it was the Westminster Cathedral one that was the very edgy so-called continental sound, but more influenced by the great boys' choirs of Germany and Austria, for instance. But I think what George created was—it's hard to pigeonhole. It was unique, a unique combination of those two sounds and a wonderful expressiveness and fragility of the sound and emotion in the sound.
You have released a number of recordings with the choir since you've been there, reminiscent of the prolific recording days of George Guest. Are many people purchasing CDs, choral CDs, these days?
Well, our CDs still do very well, but I think the CD sales internationally are going down, aren't they? You know, as people acquire more music online and through iTunes and all that sort of thing. But I find it slightly bewildering that people younger than us acquire their music in different ways. And I suppose there may come a time when we no longer make CDs. When I was organ scholar, I played the organ for the last ever LP that St. John's College Choir made.
Really?
I slightly fear I might be involved in the last ever CD, but it's no time soon. So I'm trying to continue that sort of pioneering, spreading the word about St. John's that George started. And the latest manifestation of that, of course, is through the internet. We sing about 200 services a year in our chapel. We record them, and then we choose about 52 or so to webcast every week on our choir website. And then people all around the world can listen. And I like to think that's the sort of thing George would have done had he lived a generation or two later.
In some ways, having a choir of men and boys may seem anachronistic. Why go to all the trouble to train these boys to sing in this tradition when inevitably their voices will change in a few short years? Why not just use girls?
Speaking as someone who has two very musical daughters, I am extremely eager for there to be a similar tradition for girls. And indeed, since 1991 was the time when the first major cathedral girls' choir was started in Salisbury. And since then, I should think 20 or 30, maybe even more than that, cathedrals have founded superb girls' choirs. There are some girls' choirs in Cambridge for young girls. There isn't yet one that does seven services a week like we do at St. John's or King's. And I would love to see a choir like that start in the next 20 years while I'm there. But in terms of boys, you know, I'm all for equal opportunities. But if you ask children in school to join a choir, you would get more girls joining than boys, because there's a danger that it's seen as just a sort of girly thing. So I think it's rather important to create an opportunity specifically for boys, as Scott has done and as we do in Cambridge. There is something magical about boys' voices just because of their fragility. They're only going to last until they're 13 or 14. I can't really think of anything else that children do where they're going to peak at 14 and then never be able to do that activity again for the rest of their lives.
Another place you served as organist was Wells Cathedral, which I understand is one of the highest ranked choirs in the world right now. It was there that you met our other guest today, Grand Rapids native Scott Bosher. Let me turn to you, Scott, and let me ask you how you came to sing in that illustrious choir.
Well, I first fell in love with the tradition when I was a student at Calvin College. In fact, with you, we went on an English choir tour on an interim and went to King's and St. John's. And actually, we sat and watched George Guest direct the choir, Poulenc Motets, I think it was. And I just could not get that sound out of my ear. So decided that after I finished my graduate work, I really wanted to go back and do it, and came to Wells Cathedral. And it was a really wonderful fit for me and my family. And spent 3 years singing there, and Andrew was our assistant organist, choir master, and sang for Andrew for those years, and it was just an amazing experience.
You now direct the Grand Rapids Choir of Men and Boys. How long has that choir been in existence, and when did you take over?
This coming fall will mark our 25th anniversary, so we're coming up on a quarter century, which is, we're pretty pleased with that. I took over initially in 2001. At that point, it was a choir that was serving more the other arts organizations of Grand Rapids for the symphony and the ballet and the opera whenever they needed children to sing. And I started steering the ship a little bit back more towards doing church services in the Anglican tradition. And then we couldn't quite get the energy for that going, so it nearly petered out there for a couple years. And then about 6 years ago, we got a resurgence of families who said, let's get back and do this right in the real Anglican cathedral tradition. And I said, I'm all for it. Let's go for it. And there's been no turning back. The response has been fantastic. We're now up to close to 60 singers in the choir. And having people like Andrew come on a fairly regular basis, along with others like Martin Neary. And we're in conversations right now with Stephen Clearberry to find a date for him to come in the near future. So it's very, very exciting.
As you mentioned, your choir has a main focus of church music and services such as Evensong, but yet you're not affiliated with a church.
We aren't. In fact, just as I guess they call Westminster Abbey a royal peculiar, we're a little bit of a royal peculiar here in the United States. There are quite a few RSCM, Royal School of Church Music choirs, and every single one of them is associated with a church. We are the only one that got a charter, and it took us 3-4 years to get it. That we are an RSCM chartered choir that is a nonprofit arts organization. So we're a bit unusual, but it's wonderful because our boys and our men come from probably 17 different denominations across West Michigan. Our boys, we have about 38 boys singing right now, and they come from about 27 different schools, private, public, charter. So we're a bit of a mutt, I guess you could call us. But it is just a wonderful coming together of people who love this tradition and love to really work at perfecting their skills.
You have concerts this Friday and Saturday in the spectacular acoustics of St. Andrew's Cathedral in downtown Grand Rapids. This week, you brought in Andrew Netzinger to put the finishing touches on the music. Which one of you chose the music, and what is on the program?
We went back and forth a little bit. Because I know the boys and their capabilities, I kind of propose a program to Andrew, and then he can do thumbs up or thumbs down. But we initially put it together, and one of the kind of skeletons of the structure that we're doing is Bob Chilcott's from the Kingsingers, his new St. John Passion. We hope to, in the near future, do the entire work, but we're just kind of wading into it a little bit now. We're doing three sections from the Passion and breaking them up and kind of spreading that across the entire evening, and then inserting other works, Henry Purcell anthems, Lati's Crucifixus, all this incredible music that's been written for Passion Week through the centuries.
Andrew, why have you come to work with the choir in Grand Rapids? What do you get out of it?
Oh, well, it's great to see Scott again, and I'm full of admiration for this amazing project that he does with setting up a choir along the English lines so very, very successfully here in Grand Rapids. As I think you said at the start of the interview, you know, I've been brought up in this whole tradition right from day one of my life, really, and I'm hugely privileged to be a part of the tradition in England, which has continued for so many centuries. I mean, similar traditions in France and Italy, for instance, have been rather less durable. So I'm hugely privileged to have absorbed all this experience. And if I can spend a bit of time actually sharing the knowledge I've been privileged to acquire, the experience with others, then that's great for me.
Scott, you don't charge admission to your concerts. Why is that, and what is your funding model?
Well, The music that we put is from the English cathedral tradition. And although we're not a religious organization, we're a 501c3 arts organization, I always have the feeling that what we're doing really is music that feeds people's souls. This is music of such a deep spiritual feeling. And so to charge for that to me seems wrong. For those that can't, we have a free will offering. And for those that can't afford, please come be our guest, absorb this music, let us feed your soul, let us give you something back. And then we find that there's a lot that do have the means to be able to give well and actually probably put in more than they would if they were purchasing a ticket. It all comes out. We've been very, very blessed as an organization by, as you know, the philanthropic community of West Michigan is very, very generous. And we feel that we need to be generous back to that West Michigan community by offering it as a gift.